Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. There is a murder epidemic in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, just across the border from El Paso, Texas, which is considered one of the safest cities in the United States. How can this be when more than 2,000 people died in Ciudad Juarez in 2009 alone? The U.S. State Department in March issued a travel warning to U.S. citizens to stay out of Mexico if possible. The deaths apparently are part of a nationwide killing spree, mostly around the border and linked mostly to the illegal drug trade. Thousands have died since 2006. About 2 years ago, Tony Payan, an expert on border crime at the University of Texas, El Paso, said that the government wasn't in control. Tony is a widely quoted expert on Mexican political affairs. He closely monitors the situation in Mexico, and we invited him to the show today for an update on this sad story about our closest neighbor to the south and how it affects us in the United States. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
The travel warning was issued after three people with ties to the American consulate there were murdered in March. Can you tell us about that and why that spurred a travel warning versus, you know, this rash, longtime rash of murders?
Actually, there has been a travel warning for Mexico for quite a while,
okay.
At least 2 years by the State Department. And the travel warning that the State Department issues is targeted, I would say. For example, in the last couple of days or so, they issued a travel warning for the states of Tamaulipas and Nuevo León, also border states that have seen a rise in the number of murders. That had been a travel warning for border towns for the most part. There are important portions of Mexico, of course, that are relatively calm, and there are no deaths. And so the State Department is definitely cautioning everyone that travels to Mexico to be careful where they stay. The murders in Ciudad Juarez, particularly the murders of these consular officers, is an important landmark in my view, because initially the FBI, which was collaborating in the investigations, said that it was a case of mistaken identity. And, of course, I myself doubted that. Mm-hmm. I did not think that it was possible that they would mistake consular officers for some gang member in the city. That is not the way the violence is happening. As much as we'd like to think that the violence is random, it is not. It's actually quite targeted, I would say. About 90% of it is targeted violence. So there had to be something behind it, and indeed, the El Paso Police Department conducted a major raid in El Paso, Texas, and arrested 250 members of the Aztecas gang that crosses the border every day. These may be people that are American citizens, but also collaborate with the cartel in Juarez. Obviously, the drugs have to get to El Paso and get from here to where they're going, so there's got to be people involved on this side of the border. And these members, one of them at least, confessed that they purposefully targeted these individuals, although it's still not clear why. I can speculate, though, that it's probably to try to drive a wedge between the rather broad and deep collaboration that Mexico and the United States are beginning to achieve in this war on drugs.
You've said that El Paso is a city of don't ask, don't tell. That's well known that drug cartel members and their families have lived there for many years, and yet it is one of the most peaceful cities in the United States. So you're thinking this is changing now, obviously.
Well, it's not necessarily a change. Mm-hmm. These gangs do not commit their crimes here. They prefer to kidnap people in El Paso if they are to kill them and take them to Juarez, lure them to Juarez, seduce them somehow to cross the border into Juarez, and then execute them there. El Paso remains relatively safe in terms of murder. I mean, there's obviously other problems. There's domestic violence. It's a poor city. There is a petty crime and property crime. But indeed, what we're talking about here is the murder rate, only 17 murders last year in 2009, whereas, you're right, Juarez had over 2,600. Mm-hmm. So clearly, there is something about the level of impunity in Juarez that invites chaos and the ability to commit those murders in Juarez that doesn't exist in El Paso. We also have to remember that El Paso has been for a long time a heavily militarized city. We have one of the largest army bases in town. We have thousands of Border Patrol agents, thousands of customs agents, plus the sheriff, plus the local police, plus the DA, the FBI, and other federal agencies that have substantial operations in El Paso. It is a city where the per capita, the number of investigators and law enforcement agents per capita is actually quite high. So when something happens in El Paso, they can throw the resources at it and they solve it fairly quickly. But they're well-staffed, well-funded, and they obviously have the technology and the resources, so that they can do that. You don't have that privilege or that situation in Juarez, where things are a lot more chaotic and the police forces are definitely not only corrupt but overwhelmed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tony Payan. He's the author of The Three U.S.-Mexico Border Wars, Drugs, Immigration, and Homeland Security. He is an expert on the issue of Mexican politics, and he works at the University of Texas at El Paso as an associate professor of political science. Tony, just to get back to that major raid that you mentioned, because I hadn't heard about that, isn't that unusual recognition of the prevalence of cartel members in El Paso?
Yeah, there haven't been any specific declarations made by the mayor or the governor. Mm-hmm. Of course, they would never admit that the border towns in the United States play an important role. But, of course, the police has always known that. The sheriff, Richard Wiles, in El Paso has acknowledged, for example, that since he was a cop in the streets in El Paso in 82, almost 30 years now, and that during his time as the police chief, he realized that this was a major problem in El Paso. El Paso has definitely gang members. The Los Aztecas, which is the gang that supports the Juarez cartel, not only in its operations into Juarez, but also obviously, it's the gang that is fighting El Chapo Guzman, the opponent of the Juarez cartel, that has sent some sicarios or killers into Ciudad Juarez to try to gain control of that plaza, wrested away from the Juarez cartel, are obviously a gang that began in El Paso and then moved to Juarez. But it is, in a way, an implicit recognition that this is a joint problem. It's something that President Bush, before President Barack Obama, and now President Barack Obama have acknowledged, that there is a co-responsibility on this problem, mm-hmm. that we're in this together, and that this strategy has to be a binational strategy. But the local authorities themselves, the politicians, are only now beginning to acknowledge. I think there is a couple of good city council members like Steve Ortega and Beto O'Rourke who are actually beginning to think and talk about that, but the mayor and other authorities would rather just look the other way.
Now, you've mentioned that they'd rather look the other way because there's this image of El Paso that they want to preserve, but could it be, and I'm just speculating, that you look the other way and you have less trouble in El Paso? I mean, once they start doing these kind of raids and really start going after them, won't there inevitably be some retaliation in El Paso? I mean, isn't that the way they operate?
Well, it is possible, but I think that the police in El Paso is relatively well prepared. In fact, bureaucracies are a curious thing. The El Paso Police Department has been preparing for a potential spillover of violence into El Paso. And one of the things that they've done is they've taken advantage of a series of grants by the federal government to acquire equipment, technology, and even now assault weapons for every patrol car. This is the latest request they made of the federal government. And it's surprising to us because, obviously, if you live in a very safe city where you only have 17 murders a year, mm-hmm. and most of them are actually family members killing family members, that is domestic violence, why would you want an assault weapon in every vehicle? Clearly, the police has been getting ready for that. And so I don't think that in the near future, this kind of violence is something that we will see in El Paso. I think that definitely there is the possibility of retaliation, but I think most of the retaliation will likely occur in Ciudad Juarez.
Now, when you were talking about applying for the grants, is this part of Texas Governor Rick Perry's activation of the first phase of the Texas Spillover Violence Contingency Plan?
Yes, I think the governor has been quite active in doing that. politicians tend to do that, obviously. The governor has, however, everything the governor says, you have to take, with a grain of salt. The governor is obviously facing a challenge from within his party, the Republican Party, and then he's facing a challenge in the state. I think he's eventually going to win. Of course, Texas is still very much a red state, but the border counties are some of the safest counties in the state. He has many other problems in other cities like Houston or Dallas or other places, and yet he tends to focus the attention on the border counties and border cities, which are among the safest, precisely because I think it pays off. Somebody said that it was a policy disaster, but it was a political win. And, of course, that's the way that we ought to take any politician's words on this.
Now, the violence that we're talking about now began to mount, and obviously, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but in about 2008, after Mexico's president launched a national offensive against drug lords. Mm-hmm. Is that right, the Joint Operation Chihuahua?
Yes, the Joint Operation Chihuahua began in March of 2008. Mm-hmm. That is about 2 years ago, I guess. However, I would say that the violence began to pick up in late 2007 in Ciudad Juarez, even though still imperceptibly,
okay,
because we didn't know exactly what it was about, how long it was going to last. And then, of course, the war on drugs per se, as we know it today, began almost 10 days after President Calderon took office, when he decided that he was going to take on the drug cartels, that they were becoming a danger to national security, to Mexico's stability. And then recruited the military immediately, the first president ever to pose in fatigue, and then to give an immediate pay raise to the military and then send them off to the streets. This was in December of 2006,
okay,
when he took office.
Now, he launched a national offensive against the drug lords, but it seems like so much of the violence is between the drug cartels. Why is that?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because this is a point that is often omitted. 90%, I would say, of the violence in Mexico today and for the last 3 years is really targeted violence. And these are drug lords, cartels, drug trafficking organizations, DTO, as we call them, mm-hmm, essentially targeting each other. They're competing for the corridors, for the market, for control of different police forces and the ability to produce and traffic in drugs. I think that one of the reasons is that when the government began that onslaught on these particular cartels, on these groups, one of the things that happens is you behead a cartel, for example, and President Calderon has definitely had enormous success in capturing some of the major capos, many of whom are now in U.S. prisons, by the way. Mm-hmm. Almost 350 of them have been extradited in the last 3 years. And these are major fish. We're not talking about small fish. Mm-hmm. And President Calderon, essentially, when you behead one of these capos, one of these cartels, and you take one of these capos, there ensues a battle for control. And
yeah,
that battle can take two forms. One, the lieutenants fighting among themselves for control of the organization itself. Everybody wants to succeed the big capo.
Yep.
And there may be some violence. And the second is, obviously, another cartel from somewhere else, geographically located in some other border town or some other place in Mexico, may say, okay, this is our opportunity. There is chaos in that particular group. They are weakened, and this is our chance to take over that corridor and expand our business. And that creates also a certain level of violence.
Okay. We have to take a short break. My guest is Tony Payan. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's an expert on Mexican politics as they relate to especially the drug war. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Hi, we're Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. You know, a lot of people consider themselves automotive experts.
I have this theory that it put all the strain on the alternator from the battery and...
Kelly,
stop, you're hanging yourself. Stop. It's getting embarrassing now.
It was a great idea. but give it up.
Why not run your theories by us and 5 million other listeners, too?
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk, Saturday at noon on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News and Classical Music. 70 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:21 this morning. Some sunshine today, but a good chance of showers, maybe a pop-up thunderstorm. A high of 75, rain throughout the evening, and then a chilly night, a low of 38 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 155 years. 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Tony Payen. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Texas at El Paso, and we're talking about the drug wars in Mexico and what the relationship is between Mexico and the United States regarding this and how it affects the rest of us. Tony, I was wondering about what the Mexican army is actually doing, because there also have been allegations that they're part of the disappearances, they're part of the murders.
Yes. Well, this is a very complicated strategy. And I was talking to a group yesterday, and I was telling them that during the 20th century, Mexico was occupied with three great national projects. One was the pacification of the country after the revolution in 1920, and then the creation of a Mexican national identity, and there was all kinds of dissertations written over this in the 50s and 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and then, of course, a national plan of economic development, so to speak, that began in the 1930s and ended, in my view, in the 1970s. In that century, the projects essentially left out a very important component, which was the creation of an effective judiciary and an effective police force, whether it be local, state, or national. That was just simply not a priority. When the drug traffickers came over from Colombia and began to negotiate with the Mexicans to get in the business of drug trafficking, international drug trafficking, you have a situation in which the police is simply not ready, not prepared. They're essentially a ragtag police force. And when President Calderon comes in, and most Mexican presidents prior to President Calderon had simply said, you know, we're just going to take on one at a time. We're just simply going to go after the Tijuana cartel or the Gulf cartel, mm-hmm. but it would be foolish of us to take on these cartels all at once. We simply don't have the capability. President Calderon decided that this was not the right strategy, that things were actually getting worse over time, over the decades, and that he was going to take them on. But, of course, who with or what with? And, of course, he said, well, the military is going to have to do it. And he sent the militaries out on the streets, as I mentioned, as early as December 2006. The problem with the military, obviously, is that they're not a police force. The military is not trained to read people their Miranda rights, to treat people with a certain degree of respect for human rights and so forth. I mean, ultimately, they are a brute force entity in almost any country. They're used to using certain tactics that are definitely not constitutional in any one country towards its citizens. And I think that they are committing certain violations, some of them wittingly and some of them unwittingly. Obviously, there's been army individuals that have been corrupted and are serving the cartels in Mexico. I would not say that the corruption of the army is systematic by any means, but they're quite vulnerable, and individuals can be picked by the different cartels and then bribed to turn over intelligence, to work for them in their free time, and so forth. Now, that is a problem in and of itself. The corruption of the army is a problem. President Calderon has now resorted, of course, to using the Marines for targeted operations, like the one we saw in Cuernavaca in December, where Arturo Beltran Leyva, one of the big capos in Mexico, was killed by mm-hmm. the Marines. And he's not sending the Marines out on the streets precisely because he understands that vulnerability. But obviously the military is committing all sorts of violations. And I don't mean just due process violations, meaning that they're not a cop that knows what to tell the person that's been arrested and read them the rights and tell them what's going to happen and so forth, but rather human rights violations. They take somebody in They pretty much beat him up to try to extract information from that person, to try to get that person to give them names, and they follow the chain that way. And obviously, they're essentially contributing to the chaos in Mexico instead of helping it. They're helping on the one hand because they're obviously fighting the drug traffickers. They are capturing individuals, even common criminals in the streets, extracting intelligence, however rough. But obviously, they're doing it by means that are simply not acceptable for a society that wants to be an open, free, and democratic society.
There have been stories about the relationship between the law enforcers, United States and Mexican, and these informants that they're using. Often they're horrible criminals, and they're allowed to go free because they're helping with the investigations.
Yeah, that is something that always happens. And by the way, it happens everywhere. I think that sometimes law enforcement agencies have to resort to these kinds mm-hmm. of shady characters to be able to extract the juicy information. We have the case just here in El Paso, for example, of a major criminal who was actually given a green card. Why? Because for about 2 years, over 2 years, he provided very important information about who was who in Ciudad Juarez, who was laundering money, who were the major capos, what was the organization like, and this person was providing so much information, and they tried to kick him back into Mexico, and eventually he sued, and he said, look, I provided a lot of information with a promise, and he made eventually a federal judge say, yes, indeed, you, FBI, DEA, other authorities, you made a promise, and now you have to fulfill it, and this individual is now living on this side of the border with a green card. Well, it happens in Mexico, too. Sometimes you get a hold of an individual. But I wouldn't say that Mexican authorities are that sophisticated.
Okay.
I would say that they do it, but very often their preferred method is just to beat the guy up.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tony Payen. He's a political science professor at the University of Texas at El Paso, and we're talking about their drug wars in Mexico and the relationship of the Mexican government and the United States government in fighting these wars. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. U.S. National Security Council spokesman Mike Hammer said that breaking the power of the drug trafficking organizations is a responsibility that the U.S. and Mexico must shoulder together. You spoke about that earlier, Tony. The United States has pledged $1.5 billion. It's called the Merida Initiative. What does that mean, and is $1.5 billion enough?
Well, a couple of things about the Merida Initiative. Some of us have been a critic of it, not necessarily of the collaboration. I think it's a good sign that the United States is finally willing to put its money where its mouth is. It's been a while since the United States has been pushing Mexico to fight the war on drugs. It's evidently American policy that is being fought on Mexican territory. I call that the Vietnamization of the war on drugs. The prohibitionist regime of the United States has simply been adopted by Mexico and is being fought on Mexican territory. The Merida Initiative is essentially a recognition by the United States that to simply push the country to do it is not enough, but that the United States must participate. And the original Merida Initiative, $1.4 billion over 3 years, was to provide Mexico with important equipment that Mexico would not otherwise be able to acquire in the open weapons market. Gamma ray trucks, specially equipped helicopters, computers to spy on telephone conversations and things like that. In other words, equipment that is important to fight the war on drugs, to penetrate these cartels and extract information, but that Mexico does not have the technology to do. And that is essentially what the Merida Initiative is doing. The criticism that has been made about the Merida Initiative, however, is that the money tends to flow very slowly. And to this date, only a small portion of that 1.4, and we're almost in the third year of the Merida Initiative. It was done in March 2 years ago. And yet we see that only a small amount of equipment and software and computers and so forth has flowed. And obviously not enough. More needs to be done. And I think they understand that more needs to be done. And the other criticism, of course, is that it's always a subsidy, like almost any American foreign aid. to an American company that provides the goods and services and gets the check. But, well, that's all right. I mean, as long as the equipment gets to where it needs to go, that would be fine. But even that sometimes gets wrapped up in red tape in the United States, and that's quite common.
I don't know. This just occurred to me when I was preparing for this last night, and I wondered, there's so much murder occurring there right now. And I don't know. I can't remember if it was Ciudad Juarez or another city. There's several that are listed right. with the warnings. But I wondered if there's concerns about serial murders going on that are cloaked in all the rest of this violence, because so many very poor people are being caught up in it as well.
Yeah, it's well, the one thing that we see, okay, let's see, that's a complex question, obviously.
Yeah, I
carefully sorted out. I would say that 90% of all the murders in Mexico are drug-related. Now, obviously, these are mostly gangs. These are not the capos shooting on each other. These are not the lieutenants that might live in posh neighborhoods in Mexico, and not necessarily on the border, by the way. These are veritable international organizations. Many of them no longer live on the border. But they recruit among young people, particularly poor people, because they, and young men, are quite vulnerable to this recruitment because they have no skill set. There are no jobs. Mexico has been hit very hard by the economic crisis for a long time. Mexico has not had any substantial economic growth for a very long time. It grows at very low rates in a population that is still expanding rapidly. And so there's a lot of young men that are essentially just cannon fodder for these organizations. And these are poor young men that can be recruited for as little as $100 or $200 a week, and they're willing to kill and they're willing to die for that little money. And so there is definitely a problem that is affecting the poor. And I think this is where we think that the Mexican strategy has failed. Yes, you have to have the military or the police or the law enforcement or the judicial strategy on the one side, but that's not enough. You have to invest in development. You have to invest in economic growth. You have to invest in the development of human capital and to try to recapture these young people. Otherwise, they're going to be killing each other by the thousands, as they seem to be, mm-hmm. 16,000 to 17,000 in the last during the administration of President Calderon, and obviously not enough. And these are poor people, so obviously the bodies are being put by the put forth by the lower classes in Mexico. These are ragtag, you know, dealers in the streets, in the colonias, and so forth. There is a substantial drug market in Mexico today, and these are the people that are recruited and then kill themselves in these battles. So it's not the rich and it's not the middle class. Mm-hmm. It's really the poor. Yeah.
We have an email from Eugenia. She writes, I was born in El Paso, Texas, and raised in Ciudad Juarez. I've been gone from that area for the last 10 years, and what Ciudad Juarez has turned into saddens me and scares me. I used to be able to walk on the streets to and from school. I was never worried that something would happen to me or anyone in my family. Last year, I took my 3-year-old daughter to visit the family, and the presence of soldiers was overwhelming. My question to Professor Payan is what can be done by the Mexican government to provide security to the citizens of Ciudad Juarez? What can the citizens do when they are outnumbered and outarmed? Will this turn into a form of civil war? And if so, does the U.S. need to step up and help out? That's a lot of questions. So, Tony, just jump in wherever you...
Well, very quickly, I mean, something is being done. Obviously, the presence of the military is supposed to help. It hasn't. There is a new strategy being implemented today. The military are being taken off the streets. This was just announced yesterday. And the federal police, which I think is much more professionalized, and it's supported by U.S. investigations teams, are going out in the streets and are taking over the public safety apparatus in the city. We hope that this may be a little better because the police, federal police, is considerably less corrupt than the state and the local police, and they're essentially going to take over that police and try to retrain them and try to get them ready to provide public safety, because obviously the blunt instrument strategy of using the military simply didn't work, and that is well understood now, and everybody's clamoring for the military to go. But nobody wanted them to go and then leave nothing in place. I think that what they're putting in place now, which is a specific plan known as Todos Somos Juarez, we are all Juarez, that pours, that is going to pour 3 billion, I guess, $3 billion dollars into the city in building schools and infrastructure and subsidies for food and education and things like that. That has to come along with that blunt instrument of law enforcement. And I think that they're finally waking up to the fact that you can't use a single instrument to solve what is a multifaceted problem mm-hmm. that goes all the way from poverty and development to a brisk drug market to the corridors of guns, drugs, and money laundering.
You know, there's been a huge population drop in Ciudad Juarez from about 1.3 to 1 million, 1.3 million to 1 million. Where do they go? And what do we know about the demographics of that? I would imagine they're the people who can afford and have a ways and means to get out.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. That is actually very worrying to us, because I think that a city that had doubled its population every 10 years since 1960 is now losing population at a very fast rate, and it's lost, I would say, yeah, you're absolutely right, between 300,000 and 400,000 people in the last 2 years. Who's leaving? I think the talented people, the mm-hmm. smart people, the people that have skill, the engineers, the doctors, the nurses, the students. Where are they going? Well, I would say that there's two major places where they go. One is to El Paso and other American cities. To El Paso, I would say maybe upwards of 50 to 80,000 people, perhaps. And these are the people that lived in Juarez but were American citizens.
Okay.
Very likely the person that sent you the email, for example, Eugenia, is somebody whose parents were in Juarez, and obviously the mother at some point decided to have her in El Paso, and thus she became a dual citizen or an American citizen. There are many, many children, many young people, many people in Juarez that have that privilege of dual citizenship because they were born in El Paso, Texas, and they obviously have the ability to move immediately into the United States. That's quite a few people, 80 to 100,000 people that can move into the United States immediately from Ciudad Juarez, and most of them have already done so. Now, the other 250,000 people are moving into Mexico, middle class, investors, entrepreneurs, students, sharp people, professionals that are simply taking off from other places in Mexico. There are safer cities like Guadalajara or León or Monterrey or Mexico City or other places. We have to remember also that three cities concentrate about 70% of all the violence. Juarez is number one with about 40% of all the murders in Mexico. Tijuana and Culiacan last year concentrated about another, I would say, 1,500 deaths. So I guess those three cities would concentrate about 60% of all the murders. So there are many places in Mexico that are prosperous, they're booming, I mean, they're, you know, and they're safer. Mm-hmm. I traveled throughout Mexico. I go to many, many cities, and let me tell you, no city has the feel that Juarez has. And those people are going there. The University of Texas at El Paso itself, which had 2,000 students from Juarez, is down to about 1,400 now. We have lost 600 students from Juarez. Clearly, people that have chosen to move on within the United States out to other cities or other universities, or even go to other Mexican universities.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Tony Payan. He's a political science professor at the University of Texas at El Paso. We're talking about the drug wars in Mexico and how it affects the United States. And when we return, we'll talk about the issue of the illegal drug trade and what spurs it. You know what it is. It's demand. And we'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Be a part of a studio audience with WOSU's Ann Fisher on Thursday, April 22nd at 6 p.m. Join Ann and guests at WOSU at COSI to share your thoughts and feelings about the pressing issues facing one of our city's most vibrant neighborhoods, Columbus's Short North District, or just attend to be part of a radio and TV audience for later broadcast of this WOSU event. To register, call 292-9678 or visit WOSU.org.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend will be here with host Christopher Purdy and a discussion of the best books for reading this spring with WOSU book critic Cassie Rose, book critic Bill Eichenberger, and author Donald Pollack. That's on All Sides Weekend beginning at 11. 70 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Some sunshine today, but also a good chance of showers and thunderstorms. A high of 75. Rain tonight and a low of 38 degrees. Some sunshine for Saturday, but cooler. A high of only 53.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about the drug war in Mexico and what its effect is on the United States and what the United States' responsibility is in this war. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Tony, my guest, again, is Tony Payen. He's an associate professor at the University of Texas at El Paso, and he's an expert in this issue. What about the role of U.S. demand for illegal drugs? I was reading something that you said about how Ciudad Juarez having hitched itself successfully to American patterns of consumption. Did that have to do with drug consumption or just general materialism?
No, I think both of them. Okay. I think Ciudad Juarez was in its in the years of its prosperity, I guess, in the 80s and 90s, it eventually managed to place itself as the fourth largest manufacturing center, but it bet heavily on the car industry, the automotive industry, and we all know that the automotive industry was heavily hit by the last economic and financial crisis, and therefore Juarez lost about 100,000 jobs. It's interesting to compare Tijuana, for example, with Ciudad Juarez, because I think the elites in Tijuana were a lot smarter, and they diversified their industry, and they obviously have resisted not only the violence but also the crunch, the economic crunch, much better than Ciudad Juarez. But also, I was talking about the drugs as well. I mean, it was part of that. Definitely, the United States is the largest drug market. I think we have about 30 million people in the United States that consume drugs at some level or another. Some are, of course, are addicted on a day-to-day basis to heroin or cocaine or marijuana. And some of them are just casual consumers. They may do it at the party or occasionally on the weekends or to relax and so forth, but it's part of the American consumption patterns. And I think Ciudad Juarez is very much an American city in that sense, not only on the legal goods, but also on the illegal goods, and of course, affected by anything that happens in the United States without enjoying, of course, the welfare system and the investment and all the different laws that Congress has passed to invest in trying to alleviate the crisis. Juarez does not enjoy that. It's not an American city, geographically speaking, but in almost every other way, it is a city that has plugged itself into American markets.
So what about that market for illegal drugs? We had a couple months ago, we had a show about a bust in Worthington, which is a nice middle-class suburb of Columbus, and nine kids were involved in this, and they were using heroin, most likely from Mexico.
Definitely, there is some heroin coming from Mexico. I would say it's not the major supplier of heroin. I think that heroin is now coming from Asia for the most part. But even so, it doesn't really matter. I mean, even cocaine, for example, is produced almost 96% in Colombia, and yet it has to transit through Mexico and coming to the United States. So different drugs imply different types of organizations, different profits, different ways of doing it. Marijuana, for example, is now something that the United States has become a major producer. I mean, upwards of 50% of all the marijuana consumed in the United States is now produced in the United States. Some of the sources that I talked to tell me that marijuana is in El Paso is now even coming from California. So instead of coming from Mexico, it's just being driven down from from the states that are producing marijuana. As the border gets tough and crossing drugs gets tougher and tougher and more expensive, and the possibilities of getting caught get higher, production is moving into the United States. That is also happening with confection drugs. So in that sense, I think that we ought to really say, look, this is no longer a problem of who's a producer, who's a consumer, because Mexico has also a brisk consumer market, particularly for marijuana. Marijuana is the most consumed drug almost anywhere in Mexico, in the United States, and Canada. The Canadians consume more marijuana per capita than even Americans or Mexicans. No. And so this is a major market, and we have to think of it as, look, everybody here has a consumption problem, everybody has a production problem, everybody has a transportation problem, and every kid is at risk of being recruited for this, either to consume them or to sell them at the retail level. And so this has to be a North American strategy. And I'm not going to say that the goal ought to be to end all drug production and trafficking. I think that's nearly impossible. That's a perfect society. But we should not allow these organizations to grow to the point that they become extremely powerful and they're able to challenge a government like Mexico in their own territory and essentially bring instability to an entire society. That's where I think the line has to be drawn, and it has to be done by all three countries. I think Canada ought to participate, particularly because Canada is becoming a major supplier of marijuana, even though it's now legal in Canada, and by the way, de facto legal in 14 states in the United States now.
Mm-hmm. You mean decriminalized, or?
Yeah, that's what I mean by de facto legal.
Okay.
It's essentially decriminalized, not the production, but the consumption. If you get caught with a certain amount of marijuana in California and many other states, I think New Jersey, Wisconsin was also looking into that, the last I heard, and it might have passed. 14 states, you know, essentially to say you take it away, they take the marijuana away and let the kid go off on their
But it's the production and the transportation that
right.
creates these gigantic businesses.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that I think California and other states may have the correct way of doing it. Let's medicalize it. Let's leave it out in the open. Let's make sure that that people understand what they need, how to get it, how much they're going to pay, let them pay taxes and so forth, and then concentrate on the education part of it and say, look, marijuana makes you stupid. Even though I tell my students that, I mean, some of them don't believe it because they smoke marijuana and they feel that they're perfectly functional. But I do think that it's a motivational, effective drug, but they don't believe it, and so they still smoke it. And but marijuana does provide 60 to 65% of all the capital for these DTOs. So if we just manage to get marijuana off the table and say, look, we're going to try to manage marijuana with a different set of policies, then we can focus on the other drugs, which in my view are considerably more dangerous, cocaine, heroin, and of course the confection drugs.
When you say confection drugs, what do you mean by that? I'm sorry.
Crystal, methamphetamine, anything that's chemical.
Okay.
I would call them. I group them, even though it's amazing, there is an incredible variety of them now. It began as crystal meth and things like that. Now there's all sorts of pills that kids can get in clubs and places of entertainment and parties, and there's such variety of them. It's all chemicals.
So what's the response been to your suggestion that there ought to be this conversation about drug laws?
Well, you know, I think there is a reluctance in the United States to do it. I think there was certainly a lot of reluctance under the Bush administration. I think the Obama administration is definitely beginning to shift gears. Changing drug policy, though, is not like changing directions in a fast boat. It's more like moving a liner, turning a liner around. So it has to happen very gradually. I think part of the strategy of the Obama administration, if I understand correctly what is going on, is essentially to leave it to the states, leave the marijuana issue to the states, let the states decide how much, you know, whether they're going to implement marijuana laws or not, and then focus on these other drugs and the danger that is trafficking organizations. That is one part of the strategy. But obviously the Obama administration has requested a 13% increase in the monies that are destined for the education part of it, for the prevention part of it, and for drug treatment and that kind of That had been neglected in the United States for a very long time. I think the last time we saw a very serious effort in that regard was under Nancy Reagan with the Just Say No campaign. I think the Obama is going back to that, and I think that's the right strategy. Devolve a power to the states, let the states deal with the marijuana laws, and then go aggressive on the education campaign to tell people, to educate people about the use of drugs and the dangers that they represent, and then focus all the rest of your guns into the DTOs and the dangerous drugs.
The drug trafficking organizations.
Right.
If you'd like to join this conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Tony Payen. He is associate professor at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's an expert, a widely quoted expert on Mexican political affairs, and he closely monitors the drug war situation in Mexico. Tony, we have an email from a listener, writes, is Mexico the next Colombia / Iraq, or a combination of Colombia and Iraq? And they mention, as well as we were just talking about, is what about the tens of billions of dollars spent on drug use by U.S. citizens? But, you know, in terms of our investment in Mexico, and really when you think about it, $1.5 billion, big deal. When you think about the trillions being spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you think we share this border with Mexico and invest very little in it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a long time, Mexico had not received or accepted, rather, any foreign aid by the United States. Mexico has always had a very iffy relationship with the United States. It's always been difficult because of the history between the two countries and the 1848 war that transferred the southwest U.S. territories to the United States, to U.S. sovereignty and so forth. And so Mexico has always been sort of keeping the United States at a distance and had never really accepted much aid from the United States on the basis of that, those claims and that sovereignty and so forth, those games that nations play. I think that you're right. The Merida Initiative, $1.4 billion, is really a drop in the bucket, considering that Mexico is investing about $7 to $8 billion all by itself, and considering, of course, that the drug trafficking organizations have tens of billions of dollars at their disposal. We don't know how much, though, because the numbers vary widely from 18 to 25 to 30 to 39 to 45 to 60 billion. And so nobody really knows. Nobody really has a count of how much money is involved, but we do know that it's in the tens of billions of dollars. So $1.4 billion over 3 years is really a drop in the bucket. Nonetheless, it does provide Mexico with some important equipment that it would not otherwise get to fight the war on drugs. In regard to the Colombia and the Iraqi comparison, the analogy, I would be very careful. Even Colombia and Iraq are very different cases. Iraq is not about drugs, and Colombia was about drugs. And the Colombians have not really been successful in stemming the production of drugs. What the Plan Colombia, which was a plan conducted with U.S. aid, did was to break down the very large drug trafficking organizations that were threatening the Colombian state and destabilizing the Colombian society. They were hammered very hard with U.S. help, and eventually they became smaller groups, bands of producers of cocaine that now ship it to Mexico. And the DTOs, the large organizations, are now in Mexico. So clearly, this has got to be the goal that President Calderon and even President Obama must have in mind, that they cannot allow any one organization to become so powerful that they can destabilize the state. Political, social, and economic destabilization in Mexico will be disastrous for the United States in particular, because if it happens in Haiti, there is an ocean in between, there's a sea in between. If it happens in Iraq, there is an ocean in between. If it happens in Mexico, there's nothing in between. The flood of refugees and people trying to get out and so forth would represent a problem right up against the gates of the United States. And so clearly, the stability in Mexico, the stability of the government, social stability, even Mexico's prosperity is in the interest of the United States. And that is I think, the difference. And if it was done in Colombia to redimension these DTOs and get them back in their boxes, not gone, but certainly not able to challenge the state, then that is a worthy goal, and I think it should be pursued.
You know, there was in December a somewhat unusual anti-violence protest in Ciudad Juarez. What did you make of that? I don't know. There was varying numbers of the crowd numbers varied drastically, so I don't even know what to say as far as that goes. But there were all lots of middle-class people, the ones that are left. And
Well, you're getting into another situation that I've been looking at very carefully, and that has to do with local politics. To me, clearly, the governor of the state of Chihuahua is at this point simply incompetent. He cannot face the drug trafficking. His police force is thoroughly corrupt. That is the state police. And the local police, I would say, you know, yesterday I was talking to a colleague of mine at the University in Ciudad Juarez, where I also serve in the graduate faculty, by the way. I teach in the doctoral program in Ciudad Juarez. And I was talking to one of my colleagues over there, and I... And in talking to him, because we want to do a census, a survey of the police in Juarez, and we're sort of thinking about how to go about it, obviously. The situation is so delicate that you have to be careful when you study the police force. And how much of that police force is actually at the service of the cartel, right? And if you're asking questions, if you're giving them a 120 questionnaire, so to speak, and you're asking them questions that are possibly even if it's anonymous, mm-hmm. You're asking them important questions about corruption and things like that. You know, you kind of expose yourself to the possibility that a good percentage of them, I don't know, 10, 20, 30% of them may actually be workers for the cartel itself, and they may say, okay, why is this guy asking these questions?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very cautious about how we're going to conduct that particular study. And we're talking about that, and obviously the mayor is also essentially a hapless political leader, unable to do anything. The federal government eventually had to come in with the military and now with the federal police, because these guys simply have no vision, no strategy, no leadership. However, the state and the city are governed by the PRI, the traditional party that governed Mexico for most of the 20th century, but the country is governed by the PAN. President Calderón belongs to the opposite party. And so the question there is, you know, these guys, we have an election coming up in July in Ciudad Juarez, a mayoral election.
We're running out of we're running out of time. Tony, I'm sorry. We're running out of time.
It's okay. You asked a complex question, but you're right.
Sorry. My guest, Tony Payan, political science professor at University of Texas at El Paso. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.